Number 20-2275, Taylor against the United States. Mr. Dunn.
Thank you, and good morning to the court. May it please the court, I think that this is a very straightforward procedural case. And luckily, we have the benefit of two of the preceding panel rejoining this case and hearing our arguments today. Specifically, to that point, Judge Toronto's authored opinion in the previous iteration that was before this court on page 13, starting on page 13 and continuing through the end of the case on page 14, discusses amendment of the case and when it might have been taken. So our argument is very simple this morning, that in affirming the trial court's dismissal without prejudice, that situated the case back where it was when the decision was entered. Therefore, a Rule 15 motion to amend to cure the deficiencies in the pleadings that would have led to and were recognized by the court in the previous opinion to the dismissal at this point could have been cured when the case was mandated back down to the trial court, which is exactly what we attempted to do.
Counsel, I'm having a hard time following this. I mean, a dismissal for failure to state a claim can be without prejudice, but that doesn't mean that the case is still ongoing. There's a final judgment dismissing the case. Don't you have to file a Rule 60B motion in order to reopen the case?
No, Your Honor. And here's the distinction. If we had assuming we could have filed or we should have filed a Rule 60B motion after the judgment had been entered, so the opinion came out and we could have done a Rule 15 motion, typically even after a dismissal. That's recognized in several Supreme Court cases that we mentioned in our reply brief and in our opening brief. But we would have been applying for a Rule 60 to a court that had decided it no longer had jurisdiction.
Only over part of the case.
Only over part of the case is correct. But if a court doesn't have jurisdiction over a portion of the case, it wouldn't make sense to continue on with that case without addressing what we believed, and this court agreed, was incorrect regarding that subject matter jurisdiction. So it would be counterintuitive and counter to Rule 1 for us to have been required to forego our appeal of the subject matter question in order to pursue a amendment at that point. And in reality, I think that it's fair to state that whether then or now is really a question that should be of no consequence. The rules should be read such that if we could have done it then, and we've now been correct on our subject matter jurisdiction issue, we should be able to come back to that point. The rules are supposed to be read in a way that is just. It would seem to be unjust that once a party elects to correct the subject matter jurisdiction question through the appeal, which we did, that we would then now be precluded from coming back and filing a Rule 15 motion to amend. And whether it's a Rule 15 or Rule 60 or Rule 59, as we discussed in our briefing, those are things that those rules are not really properly tailored to this situation.
That if you're stuck with Rule 59 or Rule 60, that you're out of time and can't satisfy those?
Well, we do kind of concede, yes, that actually we do concede that. That's the point, is that if we had, we don't have any of the things under Rule 59 or Rule 60 that would warrant the court. It's not, for instance, it's not my mistake. It's not a newly discovered evidence. It was the trial judge's mistake as to his jurisdiction that led to the case ending up in this situation. So we really don't qualify under Rule 59 or Rule 60.
Do you agree that when the motion to dismiss was filed in the first instance, you could, and it had included the allegation of failure to state a claim, you could have sought to amend at that point?
I think we could have, but the argument that we make is that that would have been futile. If this case and the previous decision addresses the sounding and tort jurisdictional question for the Court of Claims, our case would still have been a tort claim or, and I'm sorry, not a tort claim, but a takings claim and not a tort claim at that point. And so applying to Judge Wheeler at that point would have put us in a position of saying, well, we still want to proceed. We'll clean up the complaint. And I believe that it should be pretty clear. He had said, well, your case still ultimately sounds in tort, because he hadn't, nothing would have changed his mind on that. And so it would have been futile to come back and to argue, well, we've now cleaned up and we've added the physical takings issues of this. And he just said, well, it still sounds in tort, but you've, at best, what we could have argued is that we've now lost a claim that this court agreed with us we did have as far as the takings with regards to the jurisdictional question that the court decided. And I saw a quick flash on my screen. I didn't mean to interrupt if I did.
No, I think understood Judge O'Malley to be asking whether you agree that you could have moved to amend not after the trial judge ruled against you and dismissed the case, but after the motion to dismiss was filed before the trial judge had ruled. Anyway, I'm interested in that.
Yes, question. That's right. Judge Toronto is right in his description of my question.
Could I beg the court to...
You wouldn't have known anything about futility or pointlessness or what have you at that stage, right?
Well, I believe we did feel that it was futile at that stage because of the subject matter jurisdiction. I apologize if I'm misunderstanding.
Sorry, maybe I'm not being clear. Go back to the time when the government's motion was filed. So you don't have any ruling at that point from the trial judge. You could, at that point, have either without permission or with permission, never mind about that for a moment, sought to amend your complaint.
I apologize. I was misunderstanding. Yes, that is correct. We could have done that. But I'm not sure that we felt that there was a reason to. As we pointed out in our briefing, and this court disagreed with us on that, we felt that it was premature to rule on the motion to dismiss on grounds of failure to state a claim. We felt that there was sufficient. So we didn't agree with that assessment. So, yes, we could have filed a motion to amend and we could have gone ahead, but we didn't agree with the government in that original motion to dismiss that the claims were insufficient. In fact, we argued in front of this court previously that we felt that we had sufficiently alleged the claims, so therefore it wouldn't have made sense for us. It wouldn't have, we wouldn't have known futility at that point. That's correct. But we certainly knew what we believed was that we had a pleading that satisfied Iqbal and Twombly, and this court disagreed. So we'd have had to be able to foresee that this court was going to disagree with us on that point. So my crystal ball is good, but generally not quite that good.
Well, counsel, is there anything in our prior decision or in the actual remand order where we actually remanded for further proceedings?
No, there's not. And that's why we waited for the mandate and we filed the motion to amend. But that's why I began by discussing this court did recognize that there was a Rule 15A amendment that could have been sought even after the opinion had been issued. And that's the
where do you get that from our opinion?
Page 13 and page 14. So if we look at page 13 and 14, it very clearly discusses that any time before trial and before judgment had been entered, we could have filed a motion to amend under 15A.
Before,
so we could have done that.
Right.
Right. So the opinion comes out. We file a motion to amend before the judgment from the court comes out, conceivably, and there's a period of time there where we could have done that. It's a short period of time, mind you, but there's a period of time where we could have done that. And then this case would have been... we could have filed that motion to amend then, but again, we'd run into the futility question. I guess our issue is that we, in good faith, relied upon the points that this court was affirming a dismissal without prejudice, and it returned it to that point. So if that was the affirmation, I get the argument that we could have or should have filed a Rule 59 or Rule 60, but it doesn't make any sense that those are the only two avenues when subject matter jurisdiction has been reversed. And we did point to a couple cases that I'll just... Well, actually, I'll save those for rebuttal if it's okay with the court.
Finish your sentence.
Okay, so we raised an Eastern District of New York case, Integrated Tech and Development, Inc. versus Rosenfeld, and then also the Morongo Band of Mission Indians versus Rose from the Ninth Circuit. We think that those two are illustrative of where other districts and circuits have gone with this question, and it would make sense that this court, in line with those decisions, should allow us to file the Rule 15, the trial court should have allowed us to file the Rule 15 motion, considered it on its merits, and then proceeded with the case.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll have your rebuttal time. Let's hear from Mr. Yale.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. We'd like to address a few points. First, contrary to Mr. Dunn's suggestions just now, this court's decision in the first Taylor case did not provide for a remand. It did not provide for any further proceedings. The Taylors failed to seek rehearing. And so we just don't see that there was anything left of the case just by the plain language of the mandate. So that's the first point.
You say it's irrelevant whether it was dismissed without prejudice?
Well, the Taylors have certainly pointed to no case that provides for any sort of legal significance for that in the context of a situation when an appellate court affirms the trial court's dismissal for failure to state a claim, even if it's with prejudice. So, for example, one of the cases we cited to was a Third Circuit decision called Ahmed. That dealt with a dismissal without prejudice. The fact that it's with prejudice doesn't mean that somehow there's no legal significance to the appellate court's decision. Again, they had an opportunity to amend throughout the litigation. We filed a motion to dismiss. They certainly had ample opportunity. It seems like that's been acknowledged that they could have amended their complaint. That's very common in civil litigation, as everyone knows, that an amended complaint could be filed. Certainly, there was an oral argument. There could have been a motion at that point. They could have filed after the oral argument. And even after the decision came out, they could have, filed, a motion or a series of motions to add additional allegations if they chose to.
This is Judge Toronto. Can I just double check? Do you agree? And I think this is written about in, for example, Wright and Miller, that when a Rule 15 motion to amend is filed after the initial judgment is entered, that it has to be accompanied by either a Rule 59E or a Rule 60?
Yes, exactly, because there's been a final judgment. So, and that said, I think we cited and quoted from Wright and Miller's. There's plenty of other circuits who have specifically addressed this. We cited to the Calvary Christian case, which essentially said exactly that you first have to vacate the judgment under one of those two rules. Now, as the trial court here pointed out, Rule 59 would be unavailable as a matter of timing. It's also the case that Rule 60 has a relatively high standard, but part of that is because this what the underlying purpose, as that Calvary Christian case or Wright and Miller or many other cases have pointed out, what we're dealing with here is finality. And so this isn't a situation where it's just in the normal course of the litigation. I mean, by the Taylors, how they interpret the rules, where they can essentially just ignore Rules 59 and Rule 60, In 20 years, they could file a Rule 15 motion and the standard and to try to amend the complaint, and Rule 59 and Rule 60 wouldn't apply, and the court would need to apply the standard from Rule 15. And that just cannot be the case, but it's not the case based upon precedent and also based upon just the plain language of the rules and how they work together. So, you know, for those reasons, we certainly think the trial court did not abuse its discretion. We also, throughout the briefing below, pointed out all of the reasons why, just even if we were to go look at the regulatory takings claim and navigation easement claim, why, there just wasn't a valid claim regardless. And a lot of that was...
Put aside the regulatory taking claim. Can you quickly summarize why you think the additional facts on the, what do you call it, navigation, the physical taking claim about the overflights? Because the new complaint provides a number of details about frequency and possible effect on the calves that the original complaint did not.
Sure. And so the first point is we still don't think, and this was an issue that came up before, that sort of these, what we would characterize as sporadic overflights, is really comparable to the situations in Cosby and some of the other cases we cited where there's just hundreds and thousands of overflights in a per year and whatnot. But even setting that aside, the detail that was added makes abundantly clear that when that claim would have arisen is in 2009 or 2010. We have allegations that were added to the complaint that's saying that not only were they aware of these overflights, they were damaging the enjoyment of the property for the Taylors. That's the allegation. And they complained to the Air Force about them. And they were so bad, apparently, that they were documenting them in detail. And so, even if setting aside all of the procedural problems that we think are bases certainly to affirm the judgment and certainly demonstrate that the trial court's decision was not an error. The additional detail that was actually added just demonstrates why, there's a blatant statute of limitations problem with that particular claim.
Although that wasn't decided, was it?
Well, that specifically...
So you're asking us to say you're going to lose anyway, so don't bother me with these procedural details.
Well, we're saying on the procedural, for all the procedural reasons, the judgment should be affirmed because they certainly had ample reasons to... for timeliness, they had ample reasons before to amend their complaint. So it's contrary to the mandate. They don't go through Rule 59 and Rule 60. All those are basis to affirm the judgment of the trial court. But even beyond that, the trial court, in its opinion, also points out, to some extent in the context of Rule 60, but it also points out that if you can't state a claim, then that's a basis both under Rule 60 and under Rule 15. So is timeliness. And here,
but you're saying that that alternative way to affirm is based on futility.
Yes, it's based on futility, and it's also that's a point. The futility argument is also in the context that we went through in detail. For example, if you look through the regulatory takings claim and we're going through the Penn Central factors, we went through and compared what was added and what was originally decided when the original complaint was adjudicated by this court. And the Taylors didn't provide any meaningful response to that and sort of really deal with the first decision on the Penn Central factors. In fact, what they seem to suggest was that, well, Penn Central is very fact-intensive, and so we can't, you know, it shouldn't be essentially decided on the motion to dismiss, even though this, the prior Taylor decision, went through the Penn Central factors and did exactly that. And there are numerous other cases where Penn Central has, you know, application of the Penn Central factors has been used with respect to a motion to dismiss. So we certainly don't think on this appellate record that there's possibly an error in the trial court's decision. And it's certainly, you know, the Taylors certainly haven't demonstrated abuse of discretion. Really what they've demonstrated is that they had numerous opportunities and they, you know, really didn't comply with the procedural rules that are well established. With that, if there's no further questions, we would ask that the court affirm the judgment of the Court of Federal Claims.
Any more questions for Mr. Yale?
None for me.
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Dunn, you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. So, very quickly, I think that the crux of the matter was just reached, and the government has acknowledged that they're basing their argument on futility. Futility makes up none of the decision from the trial court in this matter at this juncture. It may have been, and if we were going to be arguing about an abuse of discretion with regards to whether or not it's futile, that would be a different appeal than where we are right now. It may end up being another appeal, but that's the point, is that instead of reaching those grounds to look at this case, the trial court skipped out and said, well, you didn't use these rules that ultimately probably wouldn't have worked for you. You're out of time on anyways because you didn't do this before. You didn't consult your crystal ball before the trial court issued its decision and decided that you should amend the complaint because we disagreed. We would have had to have gone ahead and agreed that our complaint was sufficient. We didn't, and we never did. This court disagreed with us. The posture should be that we should have had the opportunity to amend the complaint to see if we can meet the standards that the government is now arguing we can't in their futility. The reason we didn't address those is because, and it's not part of the briefing in this case, because that's not part of the decision from the lower court that's here today. So we believe that the interests of justice are served by allowing these plaintiffs to go back to test the sufficiency of their actual amended complaint to see whether it meets the standards that the district court can proceed on, and the case to be allowed to go forward from there. That would be the just, and probably I still argue the correct procedural manner for this case to proceed. And I won't belabor that anymore. Like I said, this is fairly simple, but I would stand for any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Dunn?
I don't think so.
All right. And my thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under submission.